Black Canary.
I'll need a sparring partner.
I'm Zatanna. Why do you care about some leggy dame in nylons? Or have I answered my own question? Ladies and gentlemen, it's time for magic.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of Power of Fishnets, the Black Canary and Zatanna podcast. I'm Ryan Daly, and I know I refer to a lot of episodes as very special, but trust me this time, it's not hyperbole. There are three super exciting reasons why this episode is going to be the best Power of Fishnets yet. The first two of those reasons are my guests. Joining me from the RAD Network, the hosts of such podcasts as Warlord Worlds, Trekker Talk, and Xenozoic Xenophiles. Gosh, alliteration is fun. Please welcome Darren and Ruth Sutherland. How are you guys?
Oh, thank you so much. We're happy to be here.
It is great to be back with you, Ryan. We always love getting a chance to record with you.
Absolutely. This is going to be fun. And thank you for being here. This is your first time on Power of Fishnets. Hopefully not your last.
Yeah, I hope not too. But thank you so much for inviting us.
Well, it was probably Paul Hicks's idea that I invite you. But, you know, a good idea is a good idea, regardless of the source.
So. You mean Paul did something nice for us? I might have to reconsider my opinion of him.
Why would he owe you a favor for an Anyway, folks, what are the Sutherlands here to talk about? Well, that brings me to the third reason why this episode is so special. We are taking part in the 2017 J.L. May crossover event. If you don't remember, last year, J.L. May featured 8 different podcasts, including this one, covering the DC miniseries JLA Year 1. Go back to episode 6 of Power of Fishnets to hear me and Ashford, the host of the Birds of Prey podcast, Feathers and Foes, covering JLA Year 1 Issues 3 and 4. This year, we changed things up a bit. We have expanded our numbers to include 12 different podcasts, each tackling an issue of the epic maxi-series Justice by the creative team of Alex Ross, Jim Kruger, and Doug Braithwaite. Today, Darren, Ruth, and I are going to discuss Chapter 10 of this series. That means there have already been 9 installments of this podcast crossover so far, 9 other episodes that you should check out before listening to this one. And if you'll bear with me for a minute, I'll go through the list. Justice Chapter 1 was covered by Rob and Shag on the Fire and Water podcast. Chapter 2 was covered by Chris and Cindy Franklin on Supermates. Chapter 3 covered by Diablo Frank on the Martian Manhunter podcast, The Idlehead of Diablo. Chapter 4 covered by Michael Bailey on Views from the Long Box. Chapter 5 on the Pulp to Pixel podcast. Chapter 6 on the Lantern cast. Chapter 7 on the Shazam cast. Chapter 8 on Comic Reflections. And Chapter 9 covered on the Silver and Gold podcast. Hopefully, by now you've checked out all those podcasts, or at least read the first 9 issues of Justice to keep up, because that leads us to our part, which is issue 10, and the reason I'm doing this particular chapter with these particular guest hosts is because Black Canary and Green Arrow get a bit of a spotlight in this chapter. So, Darren and Ruth, I feel like I asked you the same question a year ago on Secret Origins podcast, but what is your experience with Green Arrow?
Well, you did ask us this before, but you know what? Anyone who hasn't heard that episode should go back and listen to the entire Secret Origins podcast, because it's still the best podcast I can remember ever hearing.
You're already on the show. You don't need to say that again.
No, I have to say it again, because it was an amazing 54 episodes. I mean, it's unbelievable that you did that. But anyway, we're happy to be here again. So for people hearing us for the first time, we are huge fans of Green Arrow and Black Canary and Green Arrow for very different reasons. Just to give a little bit of background on me, I first discovered Green Arrow in the 1970s as a kid growing up in the backup stories and comics that Green Arrow would appear in then, and also in the Green Lantern Green Arrow comic series that I would read at the time. And that would have been also my first introduction to Black Canary, because she would show up occasionally in those stories. So I got introduced to both of those characters then, and they've been favorites of mine ever since.
And I would say I've always been a fan of Robin Hood, so that made it a natural fit for me to find a hero in the DC universe called Green Arrow. So longtime fan of Robin Hood and the love of the archery, and that was just such a fit And my introduction to Black Canary was through the Longbow Hunters. And there I really admired her strength and how she wanted to help out other people. And she was willing to take chances to do that. And of course, I love the Sherwood Florist shop that she had. And the design of that, how it looked a bit like a castle, was very appealing to me.
Yeah, that was really cool. What about your guys' experience with Justice, with this series so far? Before you signed on for this appearance, had you read the series? Were you a fan of it?
I actually had. I did not get it as it was first released, but I picked up the entire series through Comixology, I guess on a digital sale some years back, and read the entire series then. So I was already familiar with it, already liked it and was a fan of it, but had a really nice time rereading it to get ready for this appearance because we started at the beginning and went through the entire series.
Mm-hmm. And it's been my first and only time to have read the series was just getting ready for this show. So for me, it was, you know, fresh and new introduction to this maxi series.
What have you thought about it so far, Ruth? What is yay, thumbs up, thumbs down?
Oh, thumbs up. And a large part of that, besides getting to see so many different characters doing so many different things, is the gorgeous art. Mm-hmm. So very much enjoy this artistic world.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yeah, I didn't collect it at the time either. I actually got the Absolute Edition. I figured something like this with Alex Ross, I think his work lends itself to the big scale, the sort of treasury size. So when I knew that they were doing an Absolute Edition, I was like, you know what, I'm just going to splurge. I'm just going to invest in that. And I really, really like it. And I'm sure this is something that has been mentioned possibly 9 times before this on every episode. But story-wise, it feels like an episode of the Super Friends, but catered for a more adult audience with everything with the Legion of Doom and their preparations and the cast and the roundup. But yeah, I read this at a time when I wanted to see, you know, more sort of classic satellite era depictions of these characters in a bit of a modern context. So we got great moments with Hawkman, we got great moments with Aquaman, with Martian Manhunter and Superman, and then especially with Green Arrow and Black Canary. And prior to this issue, I think the highlight for them has really just been when they're attacked by Scarecrow and Clayface, I think in chapters 4 and 5, when you see them in their bedroom, and of course any excuse to draw Dinah almost naked. But just like the, certainly, I mean, Robin and I have talked about this, like how sexualized these characters are. Like when you put them in together, like I don't know of any other couple in comics that their sex life is as overt as this. I mean, the fact that when Clayface impersonates Black Canary, thinking that she's a natural blonde, he walks in the bedroom, but dressed as, like disguised as her. Ali thinks she's wearing the wig, and he's like, "Oh, it's going to be one of those nights. I better wear protection." And he puts in earplugs. It's like, "Oh, okay." The innuendo here. We're learning a lot about these two's private lives. I don't think we get that information about Superman and Lois Lane, but
no, we definitely don't. It is unique, and it's been unique for decades, and it's really, you know, it makes it fresh and maybe them seem a little more realistic at times. But we really appreciate it. And I really appreciate hearing about that edition of this that you picked up. That sounds amazing because Alex Ross art really does need to be enjoyed in the largest format possible. You're right.
Yeah, that was a good moment. I specifically mentioned the part about the earplugs. I want our listeners to remember that because it actually comes back and there's a recurring joke that comes back in this one. So
it does.
Speaking of that, listeners, we are going to take a short promotional break right now to play a trailer for one or two of the Sutherlands podcasts. Ooh. And then when we return, I'll tell you what happens in Justice Issue 10. So don't go away.
Warlord Worlds, a fan podcast devoted to the comic creations of Mike Grell, including Warlord, John Sable, Starslayer, Shaman's Tears, and Green Arrow. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We hope you'll join us as we discuss the stories, characters, and art in the many excellent comics from writer and artist Mike Grell.
Warlord Worlds is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
Find us at warlordworlds.com.
K Coming to media players everywhere in 2017 from the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Beginning with the origin of his comic book fandom and ending with the destruction of the universe, Professor Zoom Yukinori leads a monthly expedition through his favorite single-issue comic book stories from the Bronze Age of DC Comics, while promising unique celebrity guest perspectives in an ambitious attempt to set this program apart from other comic book review podcasts. Thrill to the imagination. Bask in the brilliance. Experience the wonder of... The Done in One Wonders Podcast Wonder Show. Discover how compressed storytelling can broaden one's mind. Listen for it wherever Fire and Water Podcast Network podcasts are networking.
Justice Issue 10 is cover dated April 2007. According to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, it came out on February 28th that year. The cover shows Green Arrow and Black Canary in a tunnel with a wall of clay bearing down on them. A wall of clay with a face. Yes, Clayface is coming for our heroes. What do you think of this cover, Darren?
I absolutely love this cover. I love the shape of the tunnel and the way the circular shape just draws your eye all the way in. There's a really great perspective there. Everything from the way Ollie's arrow, you know, starts in the corner and reaches back toward the center, the way Dinah is pivoting around. And the color scheme, of course, is fantastic with that sort of green luminescent effect that, you know, suggests Green Arrow and danger and mystery.
I really appreciate the action element of it. I think it's captured them, you know, right in the middle of movement, you know, very dynamic there. I love the way the water is splashing around, and I think the lighting that was used there is excellent.
Yeah, I do. I really like this one. You know, it's not the bright, vibrant emerald green that you would get like with Green Lantern, but like the more subdued, almost aqua green. Is just very, very interesting. And Darren, you mentioned the shape, the circular shape of the tunnel, and with Clayface kind of bearing down on them, it does create this, it's almost like a target or a bullseye effect in the center of the cover, which is perfect for Green Arrow.
Yeah.
That's an excellent observation there, Ryan.
I like that because I did feel my eyes being drawn in, and that's a perfect analogy to it as well. And then, of course, Ryan, you mentioned the wonderful upcoming teaser of what's going on with the earplugs. And then, of course, we get a nice little teaser of what's coming up here with that little bright glint of green on Oliver's arrow, which, you know, a reader just picking it up, picking the cover up might think, oh, it's just a glint of light. But, of course, in the story, it's really an important element. I like that, too.
Yeah, it is. It's like, what could it be? Is it just some sort of neon or LED light? Nope, it's something much more significant than that. So, all right, let's get into the story. Justice Chapter 10 is plotted by Alex Ross, who also inks and paints over the pencil art by Doug Braithwaite. Jim Kruger scripted the story, Todd Klein lettered it, and Joey Cavalieri edited the book. We open with a young Indian woman named Samita writing a letter to her mother and father, explaining why she had to run away. Before the supervillains came together, Samita had been disabled, both her hands amputated. The villains gave her cybernetic prosthetic hands, capable of doing anything, including writing a complex letter to her family. More than that, though, the hands make Samita feel normal. She ran away to one of the villains' super cities to be normal, to feel like the world was full of possibility for the first time in her life. Deep in the Legion of Doom's undersea base, Giganta dons a formal black dress and listens to Gorilla Grodd complain about the stupid humans they have aligned with. Grodd expects Brainiac and Lex Luthor to betray him eventually, but as long as Grodd's mind is impervious to their manipulations, he feels secure. Neither Grodd nor Giganta notice the Atom sneaking around their base at minute scale in his cool new armor. The villains, many of them in tuxedos, gather in the Grand Hall of Doom. Luthor raises a glass and congratulates the group on defeating their enemies. Meanwhile, Brainiac carries the infant Arthur Jr. in his arms, explaining to the boy his plans to create his perfect world called New Kalu that will be free of organic imperfection. Brainiac has attached brainwave electrodes mirroring his own to Arthur Jr.'s head. He plans to make Aqua Baby his cybernetic heir. Adam watches all of this, reporting back to the other heroes. He's unable to penetrate Luther's force field, which he figures means Luther is impervious to Brainiac's mind control too, since he's about the same size as the nanotech worms controlling the villains. One of said worms spots the Atom, tipping Grodd off to his presence. Grodd shouts to warn the others, and Brainiac uses Arthur Jr.'s animal telepathy, enhanced with his own tech, to try to calm Grodd. The mad gorilla realizes that Brainiac will try to control him, but just as Grodd is about to lash out in anger, the wall explodes and the Justice League of America rushes in. Each one of the heroes is armored in the protective metal coating of one of Will Magnus's creations. Green Arrow's narration reminds us that the villains have captured the friends and family of the League, people like Lois Lane, Commissioner Gordon, and Green Lantern's replacement, John Stewart. Those friends with powers or abilities, such as Supergirl, Batgirl, the Marvel family, and the Teen Titans, have been mind-controlled to fight the League. The battle begins. Superman takes on Bizarro. Captain Marvel takes on Black Adam. The Flash races around, dragging Plastic Man behind him and wrapping up Metallo, Poison Ivy, Parasite, Toy Man, Cheetah, and Scarecrow. Green Lantern, coated in the armor of iron, fights Sinestro. Green Arrow and Black Canary rush toward the Riddler. Zatanna casts the spell, Idaisnes Seora Reepesed Wan. At that moment, Riddler opens his trench coat and flashes them, which makes more sense in the context of the story than it sounds. His question marks shoot out at the armored forms of Green Arrow and Black Canary. At the same time, Captain Cold reveals himself to be the Martian Manhunter in disguise, and knocks out Gorilla Grodd with one alien Atlas-level uppercut. Caught by surprise, the villains are on the ropes. Brainiac calls in reinforcements from the brainwashed heroes and sidekicks. Green Arrow and Black Canary, bereft of armor, make their way through the sewer tunnels. But wait, weren't they just upstairs taking on the Riddler? Ah, but that was part of the plan. Zatanna cast a spell that teleported the Emerald Archer and Blonde Bombshell into the sewers, while the Metal Men, Gold and Platinum, remained topside, still in the shape of the heroes. The villains won't even know Ollie and Dinah are gone, at least not as long as Grodd is unconscious. Green Arrow and Black Canary run through the tunnels. Jean-Jean psychically navigates them toward the heroes' captured friends. Ollie knows the deadly stakes of this part of Batman's plan. Green Arrow and Black Canary are the two least powerful members of the League, and now they're even more vulnerable without the armor. If Grodd wakes up and discovers them, they're dead. Outside, the Brainiac-controlled heroes rush toward the Hall of Doom to fight the Justice League, but the Atom wasn't the only miniature hero to infiltrate the Legion's base. Rita Farr, the Doom Patrol's own size-altering Elastigirl, grows and grows and grows until she stands enormous in the path of the Teen Titans and the Marvel family. But she's all alone, until Zatanna says, "Ripa!" and the rest of the Doom Patrol, Robot Man, Negative Man, and Beast Boy, join Rita in the fight. None of them seem to notice the Clown Prince of Carnival Barkers walking around the city. Inside, the battle of the Justice League and the Legion of Doom continues to rage as Batman takes out the Riddler for making him betray his friends. Wonder Woman fights Giganta and Cheetah, and Hawkman and Hawkgirl take on Solomon Grundy, which is a throwdown I'd actually like to see a lot more of. The Parasite, still slightly juiced on Supergirl's powers, throws himself at Aquaman, but makes the mistake of threatening Mira. Aquaman skewers Parasite on his five-pointed trident. Quindent? And then races toward Brainiac, who still holds Arthur's son in his arms. Black Manta gets in Aquaman's way, and the King of the Seven Seas tries to jam his Quindent through Manta's helmet. Elsewhere in the battle, Sinestro wonders why Green Lantern isn't using his ring to fight, and Gorilla Grodd regains consciousness. He sicks his tiny nanotech worms on the Atom, who shrinks down to microscopic size to elude them. Grodd then senses Green Arrow and Black Canary in the sewers and dispatches Clayface through the ventilation system to stop them. Outside, Mary Marvel rips Robot Man's arm off, Captain Marvel Jr. takes on Negative Man, Kid Flash speed punches Beast Boy's green rhinoceros form, and Batgirl, Robin, Donna Troy, Aqualad, and Speedy hit Rita with everything they've got. Superman continues his fight with Bizarro, while his lead armor taunts Toy Man and Solomon Grundy, the latter of which does not have a good sense of humor about Led's mockery. As the battle turns worse and worse for the villains, Brainiac orders those left standing to escape into the transports that will send them to their cities. Aquaman screams out and chases his son's kidnapper. In the tunnels, Ollie and Dinah see a wall of clay barreling down on them. Black Canary could stop him with her canary cry, but Ollie tells her they need her voice in perfect condition for this mission. Green Arrow tells her to keep going forward and leave Clayface to him and his shadow. Dinah says she loves him. Ollie doesn't say it back. Green Arrow fires some arrows at Clayface, which accomplish nothing, obviously. But just before Clayface overwhelms him, Ollie's shadow reveals himself. Ralph Dibny, the world-famous elongated man, cloaked in black, stretches across the entire area of the tunnel, blocking Clayface's advance. Ralph tells Ollie he can only buy him so much time as the monster tries to eat his way through Ralph. Green Arrow salutes the elongated man, promising to tell this story if he survives. Outside, the carnival barker Joker sets out a blanket and picnic basket to watch the heroes fight. Robot Man's head, ripped from his body, lands at his feet. Negative Man, unable to stay out of his body anymore, abandons the fight against Captain Marvel Jr., who, along with Mary Marvel, takes out the rest of the Doom Patrol. The Joker pulls a detonator out of his picnic basket and announces that today is the 4th of July. Batman shoots tranquilizer darts at Lex Luthor, whose force field protects him. Luthor mocks Batman's lame attempt to penetrate his defenses, saying there is nothing in his cave that he could invent to undo his technology. Batman admits that he is just stalling Luthor, while the atom shrinks small enough to slip through the atomic structure of the force field. By the time Luthor catches on, it's too late. The atom reveals himself inside Luthor's shields, and grows just large enough to knock Luthor out cold. Green Arrow and Black Canary make it to the holding cell where the hero's friends and family are being held. Ollie puts in his earplugs, which only reminds Dinah of the last time he used them, when he didn't realize Clayface was crawling into bed with him. The cell is protected by a solid steel door. Black Canary takes a breath, and then lets out an ear-piercing, concussive sonic scream that rips the steel in half and knocks the pieces off their hinges. But there is one more line of defense keeping the heroes from their loved ones. A Brainiac-controlled Supergirl, and she's ready to kill Green Arrow and Black Canary. Ollie pulls an arrow out of his quiver, an arrow tipped with something glowing with emerald light. Black Canary says the kryptonite will kill Supergirl. Maybe she should just flatten her with her canary cry. Ollie says no, they have to stick to the plan. As Clayface stalks them from behind and Supergirl flies up to meet them, Green Arrow tells his pretty bird that he loves her, and lets the arrow fly. Supergirl, however, has super hearing. She heard them mention the kryptonite on the arrowhead and effortlessly dodges the attack at super speed. The arrow strikes John Stewart in his chest. Lois Lane, Jimmy Olsen, and the others scream, thinking Ollie just accidentally killed John and that their last hope is dashed. High above the sewers in the holding cell, the Justice League fights their enemies in the Hall of Doom, and the brainwashed Teen Titans fell the Doom Patrol, and the Joker presses his detonator, setting off a series of explosives all around the city. Fireworks for the 4th of July. As Supergirl prepares to kill Green Arrow, Ollie feels a surge of confidence, knowing after all of this that they're going to win. Why would he think such a thing? Because of the arrow he shot at John Stewart. It wasn't tipped with kryptonite. That's just what he and Dinah said so that Supergirl would hear them and stay away from the arrow until it found its true target. That target was John Stewart all along, because the glowing emerald light at the tip of the arrow was from Hal Jordan's power ring. John slips the ring on his finger and stands up, bathed in light. Green Lantern tells Supergirl she's not going to kill anyone. She's going to help them save the day, just like always. To be continued. So, what did we think about Justice Chapter 10?
Well, I'll chime in first and say, of course, we talked earlier about how much we love Alex Ross's art, and I absolutely do. And I've always felt, though, that his art lends itself more to covers and promotional material where he can just sort of let his imagination go and sort of bring anything and everything in. But here I will say his art works fabulously in this sequential art form in these issues. I really like it. The whole effect is terrific. And the series as a whole is really good. I guess I would say that these sort of giant crossover events aren't always, you know, our immediate favorite things, because there are always so many characters doing so many things and there's not a lot of time for character development or plot. Mm-hmm. And those aren't always our favorite things. But this story handles it all so well because it has more characters than most in crossovers, but it really gives them all things to do and they all feel three-dimensional and they all feel motivated and they all are, you know, their plans and there's plots and there's intrigue. It really is a well-done series. So every issue so far has been great, and this time it's building up to a lot of action in this issue.
Ruth, what about you?
I always enjoy seeing what the challenges are that each of the superheroes has to face. And, like, you know, trying to guess how are they going to get out of this dilemma or that dilemma, and seeing how often they end up helping out each other and helping, you know, problem solve together. So, again, bringing in that team aspect of it. And I think they came up with a lot of unique situations for them to, you know, sort out along the way. So that part of the adventure and action was fun for me.
And there's so much variety to this story, this issue in particular as well, because you get all this stuff down in the dark tunnel with Oliver and Dinah. Mm-hmm. But then you have all the stuff going on up above as well, you know, in the bright sunlight. And so there's a lot of nice variety in the illustration and in the variations of the battles. Lots of fighting going on, but they're all very different.
Right. A lot of different settings and approaches to the fights.
Yeah, and this, I mean, obviously we're approaching the climax. This chapter is pretty much a big battle scene, a big running battle. And we'll come back to that. Let's focus kind of on the reason that we're all here for this chapter. First of all, the Green Arrow and Black Canary segment. I do like the element. First, shout out to the other character for this podcast, Zatanna. I do like the fact that she is sort of instrumental in implementing this part of the plan, that she does her backward spell to send them out of their metal men costumes down into the sewers. Meanwhile, the metal men continue to take their shape to kind of fool the bad guys into thinking that they're still there.
I'll just have to say, Ryan, that I've listened to so many episodes of The Power of Fishnets that when I was reading this, I could hear your voice talking backwards.
I still have to record that one, but yeah, that'll be fun when I do that one. How many takes will it take me? So, yeah, I think, I mean, you did mention that every hero kind of gets their moment to shine throughout the series. And I think really we get a little bit of who Ollie is and, you know, his thought processes and what's going on in this one. And by the end of the story, like, we kind of get Batman's take on who Ollie is, too, at the last page when we get their little profile. But I like seeing that they're off on this clandestine meeting, because you do think of Green Arrow and Black Canary as more street level. You know, if you're bringing them into a battle with Black Adam, Metallo, you know, all these like huge super heavy hitters, you need to be judicious in how you use the characters whose specialty are ancient weaponry and hand-to-hand combat. So I think it's nice that they get this little stealth infiltration mission. I thought that was a really nice way to use them to really show off what they can do and why they belong on the League besides, you know, a Superman and a Wonder Woman and Green Lantern who can do world-changing things.
I really appreciate that observation, Ryan, because, you know, we're fans of Green Arrow and Black Canary. And, you know, I hear the people that complain about, well, you know, he's a copy of this person, she's a copy of that person. But the honest truth of the matter is there's no reason to only have Superman. There's no reason to only have Batman. There are more things going on in the world than any one hero can handle. So these heroes have important work that they can do, and they have significant ways that they can be heroic. But you're right. The writers have to be able to know how to use them. The same way with Aquaman, writers have to be able to know how to use him. And writers that do use them great and show why they're great. And we appreciate that. And you see it here.
Mm-hmm. What's well done.
Right. And almost feels like kind of like a commentary by either Alex Ross or Jim Kruger when they unleashed their secret weapon, their first of several secret weapons, which is Ralph Dibny, who is basically disguised as Ollie's shadow, which is an interesting tactic. And then when Clayface is coming down on them, he just wraps up and stretches himself so far that Clayface is like trapped. And he actually tells Ollie, he's like, I can feel him. He's trying to eat his way through me.
That was creepy.
Yeah, it's so disgusting, but it's such a great heroic self-sacrifice moment where this could be his end, but he's doing that to give them more time. And I love Ollie's moment. He's like, you're a hell of a leaguer, Ralph. Yeah. And then he just sort of says to himself, he's like, next time anyone says anything about Ralph Dibny, he's like, I'll tell them of this moment. I'll tell them about Elongated Man.
And I'm glad you brought that scene up, because that panel when Ralph first makes his appearance, which mm-hmm. is just as Green Arrow is shooting an arrow, that's one of our favorite panels in the entire story. As we were mm-hmm. reading through it, we both just thought, well, that whole page is unbelievable. But that particular panel was just really dynamic.
Yeah. Moving ahead, then we get to them. Dinah uses her sonic scream, her canary cry, to blow the door open on the little prison cell where the loved ones of the JLA members have all been held captive. But they're not alone. They're being guarded by a brainwashed or sort of nanotech-possessed Supergirl.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think, you know, when you've got two super teams that are led by super geniuses, either mm-hmm. Lex Luthor or Brainiac or Grodd on one side or Batman on the other, they have to be smart. So you need to kind of throw in clever twists and turns to make it seem like their strategy really was worthy of someone of their intelligence. And that's why I really love this turn at the end, when it seems like they've got a kryptonite weapon. Ollie's like, yeah, and Black Canary mentions it. She's like, your arrow is laced with kryptonite. It'll kill her. He fires it, and Supergirl effortlessly dodges, and the arrow actually sticks right in John Stewart. And Supergirl's like, yeah, you maybe shouldn't have told me it was kryptonite, because I have super hearing.
Uh-huh.
So it sounds like, oh, you screwed up. You weren't thinking about that. But then it turns out, nope, that was actually the plan all along, and they wanted Supergirl to hear that. The point was to distract her so she wouldn't stand in front of the arrow. Because it's not laced with kryptonite, the glowing green light of the arrow is actually the Green Lantern ring. It's Hal's ring. And it's picked up by John Stewart, who this is one of my favorite, like, as a last page in the story. I just love this one. You know,
oh, it was excellent. I thought it was so clever and really showed, you know, how they thought that through.
Mm-hmm. John Stewart just looks so good as the Green Lantern. Says, you're not killing anyone, any more superheroes today, Supergirl. You're going to help us save the world, just like always.
Yeah, I love that entire sequence. And I didn't remember, having read it before, what was happening there. So just like Ruth was reading it for the first time, it's like I was too. And it was like, oh, I was so disappointed. And then like, oh, I was thrilled.
Yeah. And I'm sure he forgave Ollie for shooting him in the chest with her. So, yeah, the ring can heal that up. No big deal there.
It was worth whatever pain he might have felt at the moment.
Right. So. And then one of the reasons I brought it up before we did the thing was before she blows down the door when they're outside the gates of the prison or the jail cell. And he's like, just give me a chance to put in my earplugs. And she just gives him that look. It's like, what? I'm going to be hearing about this for the rest of my life. Calling back to that joke when they were in bed when... Oh, yeah, I still think about that when Clayface climbs into bed with him disguised as her.
And that's really nice, too. You know, that's a wonderful hark back, too. And I know Ruth's sitting here pointing at it.
There's another one where they do the extreme close-up on Green Arrow's eyes before he takes that shot.
Mm-hmm.
And he chooses that moment to tell her that he loves her. And that also reflects back to an earlier issue where he internally is thinking how when he says that, it needs to be the right time.
Yeah. Lots of things. It's really well written.
Yeah, it is. And it's crazy, like the stress of it. I think he's saying this because he might not have another time, because if this plan doesn't go well, Supergirl is going to kill them.
It was a critical moment.
Like, this is the last arrow he's ever going to shoot. And if this doesn't help them, Supergirl is just going to fry him. And it could be terrifying. I mean, to go up against somebody that powerful who's not in control of their body. Yeah, it was an exciting climax, but it's just, it showed the ingenuity of them, how they don't give up, how they support each other, and how they're always more heroes than villains, which is how they're able to pull this one off, because the bad guys weren't counting on John Stewart being the Green Lantern successor.
Yeah. And Ryan, I really like the way you just sort of walk through that, because as you think about this entire issue, you can think about it very cinematically. It starts really small at the beginning with the lady who's writing the letter to her family, and it just grows and grows and grows through all those battles, and you can just see it on an upward climb. And then you get to just before this climax, and it's like you fall off a cliff when you think everything's been spoiled. But that's just to drop you down so that those next couple of pages can just surge beyond anything you expected.
Yeah.
It's very well done.
What did we think about some of the other moments, some of the moments that didn't involve our heroes, Green Arrow and Green Lantern? Like, what about the rest of the story? As I mentioned, it's basically a running battle scene for most of the 40 pages.
Yes, it is. I'll call out a few fights here or there that I especially liked. So I love the design of the like armor costume for Aquaman and the way he used the trident in his fight against Parasite.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that was excellent.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, go on, Ryan.
I was going to say he just skewers him.
Yeah,
he sure does. Parasite doesn't get a chance to touch him to try to, you know, siphon off any of his power. And then right after that, you know, it's like the very next page, you've got Aquaman then avoiding Black Manta's eye lasers coming out of his helmet. So, you know, that's just a really great sequence. And Aquaman, I know Rob and Shag will cover this, I know, in other episodes, but Aquaman gets a lot better treatment in this than was typical of this period of time. I think he really gets a nice introduction, nice things to do. He gets to show, you know, lots of strength, and the scenes in Atlantis at the beginning in issue one are just beautiful. Mm-hmm. I love those by Alex Ross.
Yeah,
I agree. Gorgeous. I would actually love to see a whole little mini series that would would be set there by Alex Ross.
Yeah, we'll ask him that.
Yeah, let's do that.
Aquaman was definitely one of my favorite heroes at the time that I was reading this. So everything that you mentioned, I love it. The first issue of this was pretty much just all him, and even though he got taken down, but then we find out all of these new things about the way, like, they really kind of looked at Aquaman in a different lens. And it's like, okay, well, what does it mean that he can communicate with animals? Let's step back, and what can that actually do, and how can that be applied? And it's really interesting the way, and how he basically just self-heals himself like a chameleon, even after they take his brain apart. It basically he needs time to rebuild it.
I love that. It was like, in the end, no one had to save him. Someone just had to think, hey, we need to put him in some water.
Yeah.
And he'll take care of himself. I love that. And I'll give a shout out right now, because I had marked several pages myself, because I love the battles with Rita, with the sidekicks. Those were just terrific. So we were talking about Paul earlier. I'll just say that I also love seeing the Doom Patrol in this series, because they're not traditionally part of the Justice League, but I thought they had some nice little moments in here as well. And I really appreciated that, because they're favorites as well. What were some of your favorites?
A lot of those same things. Right when the battle begins, I like, as you know, Zatanna is teleporting away, or teleporting Green Arrow and Black Canary away from that. Riddler does his thing where he opens up his, like a flasher opens up his trench coat, except all these riddle things. But just in the corner of that, I love the image of Martian Manhunter revealing himself. He was disguised as Captain Cold and knocking out Gorilla Grodd with just that one punch. And I think they later, like, comment is like, I don't know how he was able to disguise himself to the point that Grodd couldn't identify him, but
it wasn't that terrific. And I just heard you say one punch, and now all I can hear is that sound effect from Shag.
I'll just see if I can borrow that one. But yeah, the Doom Patrol do look really good, even on on that first page where we see the Teen Titans and Batgirl and everybody rushing off into battle. The panel below that, we got Robot Man, that close-up of Negative Man's face with his glowing eyes.
Oh yeah,
it just looked really, really cool.
Yes, I like that one too.
I'm surprised we don't get a battle between Rita and Giganta. It seems like it would have been obvious, but they're not really in the same place during this battle.
Right, and I had expected that.
Yeah, it is. I guess maybe that's why they didn't do it, is everybody would have expected it. And I think maybe that's why I love that battle between her and all the sidekicks, because that's a really great two-page spread. I love that one, because you have across the top of the page, it's bright sunlight with their battle. At the bottom of the page, you've got In the Dark Tunnels with Oliver and Black Canary. But I just love the perspective on that, too. So maybe that's why they decided that, it would have been too obvious. Let's do this instead. And it certainly looks dynamic. Ruth's turn to that page. I love that. Yeah.
And of course, we have Carnival Barker Joker doing his own stick talking to himself. And then like, Robot Man's head just falls falls away from him.
I loved where it looked like he was just going out to have a quiet little picnic. You know, calm scene. And then you find out what's in the basket.
Yeah. It was intense. And then I love that the Atom spends the entire issue disabling Lex Luthor's force field. That's another character who I love, and you have to be judicious and really clever in how you use him. So it seems like he's not there, but it's just because he's so small you don't see him until he until he pops up and he's disabled the force field, and just, again, one punch knocks out Luthor.
Another nice reveal. There are so many of those here, yes.
Yeah, and that's, again, that's what I like about some of these later chapters, when you see the plane plan coming together and the reveals that you didn't notice until you needed to see them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it looks like the Doom Patrol did have to take it on the chin in order for the Justice League to get everything in order for them to succeed. So I guess Mike and Paul are going to have something to say about that later on.
I'm sure they will. But, you know, at least it was an enemy this time instead of someone from within the team.
Yes. Good point.
Any other big thoughts or final thoughts? I mean, like I said, I love this issue just because of all of the action. And sometimes, I mean, when it comes to Alex Ross's art, you know, he's so good at those poster shots and making these characters, giving them a sort of photorealism. And sometimes I think he's better when he just has one character to focus on, you know, like the splash pages. Then the characters look larger than life. There are a few times in this when, between how many bodies are on the page and the coloring, the sort of lack of like heavy inks that are kind of defining the images, I do think some elements of the battle aren't being shown as clearly as they could be. It just makes you, I think you have to work a little bit harder to see everything. But if you do make that effort, if you do really scrutinize these pages closely, you see some really cool things. Some really nice little moments of, you know, Cheetah and Wonder Woman fighting in the background. There's actually, there's a moment, I'm trying to remember what page where, but there's a moment between Sinestro and Hal when Sinestro is actually saying, "Where is the ring?"
Oh, yes. I remember that panel you're talking about. It's like in the upper right side.
Yeah, because Hal isn't fighting with his Green Lantern power ring. He's got the armor on and you can see it glowing like the Green Lantern, but he's not using the power of the ring for the fight. So,
Yeah, it's on the page where Aquaman is avoiding Black Manta's lasers. I remembered that the position of it from reading that page. Yeah, that's really good. Again, foreshadowing, but it's easy to miss. So you still don't get, you know, it doesn't give away the ending. But when you get the ending, you think, oh, I could have figured it out, but I didn't.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of foreshadowing that Hal isn't fighting with the ring because he doesn't have it. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really, really cool. It's, not something you notice the first time around, but upon the reread, it makes more sense.
I appreciate you talking about Alex Ross, too. I absolutely love the art of Alex Ross, but sort of like what I was trying to say earlier, and sort of you're saying something now about it, too, which is his art works so well, large, blown up, and sort of like self-contained. It's not always the best for sequential art or for a sequential story. Here it works really well, but I know exactly what you're talking about because as Ruth and I were reading them together, we would stop from now and then and one of us would ask the other, what just happened? Because every now and then you can get confused because there's just so much everywhere, but it makes you go back and reread it because we read this issue three times in getting ready for this just because of that. It's easy not to pick it all up, but it's worth the effort because it's just gorgeous to look at.
You were reading it digitally. Did you read it like with the guided view where you just have like one panel at a time?
That's the way we always read. I love that feature about Comixology. And we have ours set up so that as it starts a new page, you don't see the page. So as you go into a new page, you just see the panels. And then when you get to the last panel, it zooms out and you see the whole page. I love it that way because nothing gets given away. But at the end, you still get a chance to see the whole page.
Okay.
That's my favorite way to read it. So that's the way we read it.
I was wondering if that would kind of help because especially in a chapter like this, a lot of the panels aren't, you know, grid shaped, like square, like boxes. A lot of them are more kind of angular, things like that. And I was wondering if the guided view would help or hurt that flow or if it would cut off certain parts of the background battle scene. And maybe I don't know if it would be easier or harder to follow the story with that guided view version.
It was really well done. We've read all 10 issues so far now this way, and I don't remember if it was in this issue or in another issue. I would say overall it really helped because it did flow really well. They did a nice job of when they did the zooms that you didn't get too much of other adjoining panels that it was confusing, but it didn't crop off too much either. I really liked the way they did it. I remember just one time in one issue where they obviously did three panels out of sequence. It's like they did the first panel, then the third panel, then the second panel because the conversation didn't flow right.
Oh, yeah.
So there was one mistake, but it really helped, I think, for the most part.
I like getting the close-up, you know, zoomed-in view because, like we're talking about with this issue, there's so many characters and so many things going on. It helped me be able to see and distinguish everything.
Mm-hmm. You can see the background stuff a little more closely, plus the fact that neither one of us can see very well now. Now that we're over 29.
That's true.
All right. Well, any other final thoughts on Justice Chapter 10?
I'll just say we've talked a lot about Alex Ross. I'll say just one more thing, which is we first discovered Alex Ross when we picked up Astro City.
Brand new
back in the 1990s. Yeah, his covers made that jump out at us, and we got that and read it. I know Dr. G and Pulp to Pixel's part of this crossover, so I hope everybody's listening to his Astro City podcast. And then, of course, the other thing we love about Alex Ross is he did some wonderful promotional art for Gatchaman, which is a Japanese anime series known here in the U.S. as Battle for the Planets. And that artwork he did for that is some of our favorite. We have that art book.
Just at the end of every issue of Justice, we get this little thing from Batman's Batcave when he has his little dossiers of the different characters. We get the one for Green Arrow and for Black Canary at the end of this one. And first, he kind of describes Green Arrow. It's kind of funny. He's like, you know, this is what my life could have been like if I didn't have the family tragedy. He's like, and in a way, like, you know, Ollie wasn't formed out of the tragedy of losing his parents. His crucible moment came later on in his life when he was stranded on this island and had to force himself to live. And it gave him this mission. And it's nice that he kind of has this moment where he identifies with both Oliver Queen and Green Arrow. And he can see both parts of this man and like what drives him. I thought that was a really cool insight that they included there.
And I like that too, Ryan. You mentioned something about that earlier, how they were doing some of these internalized conversations, mm-hmm. like with Aquaman, and they do it there with Green Arrow. That's sort of directed at the people who say, well, Green Arrow is just a copy of Batman. They're basically saying, here's our response to that. And I liked that. I liked what they said.
Ruth, any thoughts on that?
I think it was fun to get Batman's perspective on all the different players along the way. It's like, oh, here's what Batman thinks about everybody. And the artwork that goes along with all of those, and especially this Green Arrow and Black Canary on this index sheet, is gorgeous.
Yes.
I like his commentary on Black Canary and how running the flower shop sort of keeps her grounded, keeps her human. It shows her compassion and her ability to connect with the normal human life. And that they're both stronger together because of their love for each other, which very cool. Very cool.
Absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. This was fun revisiting this series after a while. I really do like this story. This was a fun chapter. Thank you very much for joining me on this one. So, Darren and Ruth, where else can people find you? What other podcasts would you recommend people listen to?
All three of ours. So, we have three podcasts. They're each focused on one of our three favorite comic creators.
So let me say, Trekker Talk, it's not about Star Trek, but it is about the adventures of a 23rd century bounty hunter, and her name is Mercy St. Clair. And she's from the sci-fi comic Trekker by writer and artist Ron Randall. And the series is a blend of, I would say, classic sci-fi adventure and noir mystery, and it's set in a retroist kind of future.
And our next podcast actually goes hand in hand with this, which is why Ryan invited us on, because we do the Warlord Worlds podcast, which is about the mini comics of writer and artist Mike Grell. That includes his Warlord and John Sable, as well as his wonderful run on Green Arrow from the Longbow Hunters all the way through all 80 issues. We're covering them all. And we occasionally do some other of his comics as well. And this is a terrific time. We've got a little bit of an unintended crossover ourselves here with Ryan, because this year is the 30th anniversary of Mike Grell's The Longbow Hunters. And we had the opportunity to interview him just last month all about Green Arrow and his run on that character and why he loves that character to celebrate the 30th anniversary. I'm in the middle of editing it, and it's going to be our May episode of Warlord Worlds. So be sure and come over and listen to some more Green Arrow stuff from Mike Grell.
I always love hearing him talk, so I'm excited about being able to share that with others. And I'll add our third podcast, that's Xenozoic Xenophiles, and that's about the Cadillacs and Dinosaurs series called Xenozoic Tales by writer and artist Mark Schultz. And for that one, we just cover one issue each episode. And as we move forward, we may include some of his other works, including the novella he did called Storms at Sea.
And I'll wrap things up quickly because I know we're getting wordy, but I'll just say that we've been fortunate to meet all three of those creators and interview all three of them. So if you want to try out our shows, look for the interview episodes in each series first and start with those and see what you think. And you can find all of our shows on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and even YouTube.
thank you very much once again for joining me on this episode. It was great to talk to you. I'm sure I will have you back on this podcast before too long, assuming the next episode isn't too long away. Who knows how that'll go with my schedule. But for those of you listening, if you want to abandon me right now, because after the break I'm going to do listener feedback, if you don't care so much about that, you can follow this podcast crossover to its next installments. Chapter 11 will be covered on Waiting for Doom, and Chapter 12, the finale, will be wrapped up on Justice's First Dawn. Check out those podcasts. Check out Darren and Ruth's podcast. And I'm going to take another promo break, probably to promote another one of the Sutherlands podcasts. And when I come back from that, I will have listener feedback from previous episodes of the show. Don't go away.
Trekker Talk, a fan podcast devoted to the adventures of 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the pages of Trekker Comics by creator, writer, and artist Ron Randall. I'm Darren.
And I'm Ruth. We'll be discussing the stories, characters, and art in this excellent retro sci-fi adventure series, as well as having side conversations about other areas of fandom.
We hope you'll join us as we travel from the dangerous backstreets of New Gallif to the depths of outer space and everywhere in between.
Trekker Talk is available at podbean.com and on iTunes and Stitcher.
In 2011, the irredeemable Shag and Aqua Rob Kelly teamed up to create the Fire and Water podcast. In 2016, they teamed up with Ryan Daly, The Franklins, and Siskoid to form the Fire and Water Podcast Network. A network built on teaming up needs a show about team-ups.
Marvel Team-Up.
Yes.
The Brave and the Bold?
You know it.
Marvel 2-in-1.
It's clobbering time.
DC Comics presents.
Of course.
Supervillain Team-Up?
Good idea.
Youngblood X-Force?
Technically.
FW Team Up, coming this summer, only from the Fire and Water Podcast Network.
Okay, I'm back to read your comments left on the Fire and Water website after last episode. If you don't remember, and it was a little while ago, Kyle Benning joined me on that episode to cover the Superman and Dr. Fate team-up with Zatanna's cameo in World's Finest 208. The first comment came from Rob Kelly of the Film and Water podcast, Fire and Water podcast, and the upcoming Superman Minute podcast. Rob said, "This is a great story, and that cover is one of the great Neil Adams images, and that's saying something. Dr. Fate is one of those costume designs that looks classic yet still modern and fresh. Part of it must be the relatively unusual color scheme in the simple design. Unlike Lil Shag, it never bothered me he seemed to be able to pop into other Earths with ease. I always figured it's magic. Have Dr. Fate and Zatanna ever just teamed up by themselves?" Not to my knowledge, no. They may have appeared together in some magic groups, but I don't think they ever partnered together. And I'm actually going to speak a little more to this point later on after I read Diablo Frank's comment. But before that, Dr. Ange from the Supergirl blog Comic Box Commentary said, "A couple of things. As is noted, this is a time when Kryptonite was gone, at least for those writers and editors who glommed onto the Kryptonite Nevermore premise. In Superman 233, Morgan Edge says, 'Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely,' the first place I ever read that maxim. So removing a magical weakness now would be real crazy. Second, I had to laugh at the 'whatever is big enough to need Superman and Dr. Fate has to be a massive threat' comment. In DC Comics Presents 23, they team up to defeat a spectral pirate. Superman even gets chained into doing the rowing. Not exactly the Anti-Monitor." I don't know. I would read a crisis-level threat where the bad guys are ghost pirates. Maybe just me. Bradley Null said, "Fun." Chris Franklin from the Supermates podcast, Batman Nightcast, and the upcoming Superman Minute said, "I agree wholeheartedly about Dr. Fate. There's just something about that look. And I still say DC screwed the pooch when they threw away the most classic version at the height of his popularity around 1987. Sorry, Shag, it's true. I'm waiting for Kyle to show up on Ohatmu or not with a fake female French-Canadian accent. Or he could go over to Lonely Hearts and actually talk Transformers Beast Wars with Fern and Marty. To which Sisko had replied, "We're not taking on new girls at the moment. Beast Wars will find a home in Saturday Morning Fever, not Lonely Hearts. But obviously, Kyle could do a voice in Romance Comics Theater if he wanted." Sounds like it's up to you, Kyle. The romance lovers need your voice. And finally, Diablo Frank of the Rolled Spine Podcast Network said, "This is the sort of story that I can't focus on even when people are just talking about it. But that's a great cover. I love the classic Dr. Fate look, and having it rendered by Neil Adams doesn't hurt. I'm not actually keen on Zatanna teaming up with Fate, as a little magic user play goes a long way. Vaguely defined powers with arbitrary limits doesn't necessarily add value when doubled. Virtually any other DC sorcery type would contrast better against Z's comparative purity, but Fate is too much of a white knight his own self. I'm also not that big on Superman hanging out with Z. She's always been the accessible, relatively normal mage that fits better in a Gotham than a Metropolis. It doesn't look as cool when a stage magician is helping to pull the earth by a giant chain." To the first part, I think Frank is replying to Rob's comment about Fate and Zatanna teaming up, because they don't, actually, in World's Finest 208. They don't even have a scene together. But I do agree, a team-up between them isn't something that really interests me because, yeah, they're just both magic users. They can do a lot of the same things, and because there's no established cap on either of their powers, they shouldn't really be in a situation that requires two of them to do anything. I also think it's boring to have two characters with the same shtick partnering up for special occasions, especially when one of them is clearly superior to the other, and in this case I mean Fate. It would be like Green Arrow teaming up with Roy Harper if they had never been partners in the first place. The world's best archer teaming up with the world's second best archer. Okay, why do you need the second best in that story? As for the second point, while I agree that Zatanna would gel better in the milieu of Gotham than Metropolis, I don't think that's reason to keep her from teaming up with Superman. I think the opposite, in fact. That, I think, is the spirit of the rotating team-up book that Siskoid is going to be spearheading in the upcoming FW Team-Up podcast. I love it when characters with vastly different styles and powers and just attitudes get thrown together. That's why I always loved Black Canary teaming up with Starman more than with Green Arrow or Batman. Now, that doesn't mean I want Zatanna to be a staple of Superman's family of books and characters, but I love any adventure that would bring the two of them together. And, well, that is going to do it for this episode of Power of Fishnets, and that is going to wrap up Chapter 10 of the JL May 2017 podcast crossover starring Justice. I want to thank my wonderful guests, Darren and Ruth Sutherland, and invite you to check out any of their awesome shows. I also want to thank you, the listeners, and all of the other podcast hosts who made this crossover so much fun. Big shout out to Flanger and Mike over at the Doom Patrol podcast, Waiting for Doom. Those guys organized and coordinated this whole thing, which is great, and you can thank them all the more by tuning into their next episode, because they are covering Justice Chapter 11. That's right, to find out what comes next in this extraordinary adventure, tune into Waiting for Doom. And I will talk to you whenever. Power of Fishnets is a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. Feedback for the show can be left at fireandwaterpodcast.com or the Power of Fishnets Facebook page. You can also find me on Twitter at RyanDaily01, or you can send an email to rdailypodcast@gmail.com. Power of Fishnets is not affiliated with DC Comics, and the views expressed on the show belong solely to the speaker. All music, audio clips, and quoted text are used for entertainment purposes and believed covered under fair use. And since I make no money off this podcast, no copyright infringement is intended. Thanks for listening. Shut the thrill, right to kill.